Hi, my name is Lee. I'm an alcoholic. It's so cool to be here. I was asking the gentleman next to me what the setup is here. I've been here before, but it was like a meeting, and he had told me that there's alumni and there's active clients here, and I'm so jealous of you guys because I tried to come here when I was in active addiction, but I was arrested before I could make it here. I was arrested a lot, like 80% chance when I drank that I would get arrested. Public intoxication, fist fighting, but DWIs, mainly DWIs. And that's how I ended up finding AA. I have between the ages of 24 and 28, I accumulated 4 DWIs. The first one, I was like, oh, it's bad luck, female Asian driver, no big deal. And then second one, I was like, just super bad luck, no big deal. Third one, I was like, maybe it's more than that. And I actually knew deep down for a long time before I stopped drinking that the way I drank and the way that other people drank, I was always watching how other people drank. It was totally different. Very, very, very different. And when I was getting, so I had got my third DWI, I was like 26. And my parents at this point, who are financially supporting me, because when you're active in addiction, that's your full-time job. Like, I couldn't do anything else but drink all day, every day. And my parents were, they loved me so much that they didn't know what they were actually doing was enabling me. But at this point, after my third one, which was a felony, they were like, we're done with you, ma'am. Like, you're on your own. So I got a court-ordered attorney. And he said, all right, I need you to sign this affidavit that you're not going to drive. And also what they want you to do is do like a 3-month SMART program, which was like a campus on Del Valley, right? And I was like, oh, my God, no. No. I need probation. And he was like, they're not going to give you that because you've done this 3 times in the last, like, 24 months. They're not, it's either this or like jail. And I was like, I don't want either of those things. he's like, okay. And I refused to sign. So I dragged it out every month. We met on a Thursday and he's like, this is what they're giving you. They're still offering you 3 months, but now they want you to wear an ankle monitor. And I was like, oh, hell no. This got even worse. Like, I'm not signing for this. I dragged this out for 6 months. From the very 6 months comes up, and he's like, when we go to court, you're going to decide what you're going to do. And at this point, I was really obsessed about what people are going to think. Am I going to go on vacation for 3 months? Am I going to go find myself on a spiritual journey? Like, what to tell people about why I was missing from Facebook? Because everybody's going to want to know. Well, we were meeting on a Thursday. Okay, Monday, I start to get real, like, itchy. And by the way, I signed that affidavit, but I'm drinking nonstop all day. Because consequences don't scare me. They actually embolden me. I have no other way to deal with terrible feelings but to drink it away. So Monday, I get real, like, hot and itchy, and I'm like, what to do? I'm going to go binge drinking. So at this point, too, in my life, my friends have stopped. I didn't have very many friends. Nobody would drink with me because I was unpredictable when I drank. And I was one of these women who, it's so sad to think about, but I would just drive myself, go to a bar, and drink on my own. And I was at like a Papacito's off 35, drinking by myself, eating chicken enchiladas, but my motor skills are gone. So it's like ending up on my shirt, I'm drinking margaritas, and get in my car to try to go to Common Interest by myself. And I see these police lights behind me. I hadn't signed paperwork yet for my third DWI, and I'm shit-faced, okay? I pull over, and I knew the jig was up. I was like, this is really bad. I think this is really bad. So I get taken to jail because I'm super drunk. And my attorney, when I finally was able to get in touch with him, he was like, what the hell? I was in court and I got handed a post-it note saying that you were arrested for a DWI. We're doing court tomorrow. Like, oh, and they also gave me no bond. Like, I think murderers can get out of jail. I couldn't get out of jail. They were like, no, ma'am, we're not going to let you go. So no bond. And he goes, you know, like, I don't know if he was like, I don't think I've ever seen this where you're like going in the process of signing for a third DWI and then getting another one. So I got 40 DWIs now, and suddenly they're not offering me 3-month SMART program. So I was like, remember that thing they said about the 3-month SMART program? Can I still have that? He's like, no, ma'am, they will not give that to you. In fact, they're going to give you 7 years TDC. I was like, no, no. And he's like, yes, yes, totally yes. Or you can go and do SAFE-P, which is a substance abuse, felony, like probation, like felony rehabilitation. It's out in Burnet and it's a year long. I took that because I knew that I needed the help, but it was also shorter than 7 years. It was 1 year. I was like, okay, I'll do this thing. So I go off to, I'm sitting in jail and awaiting like a bed at SafeP. And one day they come in and they go, it's okay. they go, pack all your things. And I was like, oh, I got a bed at SafeP. And they took me out to this little room where they gave me back like the clothes I was wearing, which at the time, that's how long ago it was like a juicy, like couture jumpsuit, like the matching kind. It was a long time ago. And, they released me because there was an error in paperwork. So I was out for another 6 months. So after they released me, the first thing I did is go to a bar and start drinking. They sent me a letter and they were like, we've made a huge mistake. We need you to come back. And I was like, yeah, right. No. I'm not coming back. And my, they had sent somebody from the court to come and like knock on my apartment. And I knew he had a little clipboard. I just knew. I was like looking out my window and he would knock on the door and just try to like rearrest me. But I was like, that's your mistake. I'm not going to go back to jail willingly. Well, how did I end up back in jail was I was downtown at the Dirty Dog Bar. And the boyfriend I had at the time, his ex-girlfriend worked next door at Coyote Ugly. So for some reason, I was blaming that on like the door guy at Coyote Ugly and wanted to fight him. And I'm blacked out drunk. And I try to fight grown men who don't look at me any type of way. I just assume that they've looked at me wrong, and there I go. So I'm in the middle of, like, swinging, and I get arrested for public intoxication. And I was lucky that I wasn't charged with assault. So I go in front of the judge the next day, and he's like, so you have 40 DWIs. You abscond from the law. Like, we asked you to come back. Like, supposedly you're supposed to just go back when they ask you, which I think is super unreasonable. Which one of us would go? I didn't. So I'm looking at him like, are you kidding me? I would never come. I'm not gonna come back. So he goes, so you have like, you're like 28. You have 4 DWIs. You kind of slip past us. We asked you to come back. You don't come back. And then when we finally get you, you're arrested for public intoxication for fighting on 6th Street. Like, you really need help. And at this point, deep down inside, I knew that I did need help. So I went to SafeP and was there for about a year. And my mom would write me these letters, and she had no idea. She thinks it's a place like this where your family can come. And at this point, this place looks like Malibu's to me. Like, I would love to be here. This place is run by the Texas Department of Corrections. So you wear prison whites. You bend over and cough when you have a visitor. There's barbed wire outside. It's a prison system. Like, I thought it was like rehab, that the state was funding. It's not. It's like, it's prison. So my mom would write me these letters over Thanksgiving. I didn't know what to tell people. I just kind of disappeared. I told my mom, I'm just taking a little sabbatical. And I was too ashamed to tell them about where I was. I was in Austin. They lived in Dallas. And they're I'll get to that in a minute, but we're an immigrant family. So they don't really understand the legal system. There's a lot of stuff that you could just like lie to them about and they'll just believe it because they don't know. They didn't grow up here. She, over Thanksgiving, she wrote a letter and was like, oh, can we come and get you and take you to lunch for Thanksgiving and then bring you right back? And I was like, no, you can't. They're not going to allow that. And then for Christmas, she was like, I'm going to send you a bottle of Chanel No. 5 in the mail. Tell me when you get it. I'm sure they had a lot of fun with my mom in the mail room. So I'm going to back up about like how I ended up here. I was born in China. And when I was 3, my dad, who was a very smart, brilliant man, a big nerd, okay, big nerd, was able to test well enough and do well enough in school that he ended up getting like a scholarship and being able to study here in the United States, which is like hitting the damn lottery in China. Everybody in China in the mid-'80s, early mid-'80s, wanted to get out of China and come to America and live the American dream. You know, this was like the gold standard. So my dad was able to leave and he left me with my mom. I was 3 years old. And my mom tried her best as like a single parent with me. And when I was 6, my dad came back for my birthday. And he came back to bring us to the United States. What happened was this 3 years that he was gone, every week my mom would take me on a bus in China and go to this, and we would just all day travel to this big gray government building and wait in line. And I remember she would have to bribe me with food, and I was a kid, and we would just do this over and over and over and over again, and I never understood what it was. So one day we were leaving the government building, and we see like a swarm of people rush us. And she picks me up really quick because she thinks I'm going to get lost in the crowd. And people are grabbing at her, like grabbing at her. Oh my God, how did you do it? What did you say to them? What was the thing that you said? And it turns out that our visas were approved to go to the United States. We got to leave communist China to go to the land of the free. And my God, it was like winning the lottery twice, you know? So my dad got the good news, came back, and my mom was a nurse, came from a really great family. She was 33 at this point, or her early 30s. And her husband said, I'm going to take you and our kid over to China. You're going to learn the language, and this is where we're going to live. And I'm sure she didn't want to do it. And later on, as an adult, she had told me, I didn't have any choice. I did it because of for you. So we immigrated to the States, didn't know the language, dirt freaking poor, grew up so, so poor. But I always knew growing up that the reason why my parents did this, sacrificed so much, was so that me, their only child, who's a girl, growing up in communist China, there's not a whole lot of opportunity for us, and they did the best they could to bring me here so that I could live the life that they wanted me to have. And the pressure was enormous, enormous. And I was already like, somebody had told me, I heard in a meeting how she knew she was alcoholic. And she had said, when I was a little kid, I had a sister, and then our dad would like pick us up when he saw us and like swing us around. But he always picked up my sister better than he picked up me and swung her around differently than he swung around me. And it's just this sort of like, I'm different kind of feeling, or I'm better than, or I'm not as good as, or I'm being treated differently. And that started when I was a child. Like if I had to say, oh, how did I know I was alcoholic? It wasn't like the massive amounts of Jaeger bombs that I was putting away and couldn't stop. It wasn't the relationships I ruined. It started when I was a kid and this deep feeling of disconnectedness, looking around and feeling like I'm different and I'm better than you, but I'm worse than you. I just know that it's either one of those things, but I'm different than you. And I think alcohol comes in and it fills that and it fixes it for just a little bit. So my family, And I'm not like a stupid person, but I wasn't able to get really, really good grades like a lot of other Asian kids do. And I don't know if it's genetic. For a long time, I was like, is this genetic? Because I don't understand why everybody who's Asian got super good grades, except for me. Like, I did okay. And I remember coming home, and I would get like 92s, which is a pretty good grade. And my dad's like, like, you need 100. I was like, all right. So finally I got 100, and I was so excited. It must have been like in like seventh grade or something. And I was like, Dad, I was just super proud of this, waiting for my dad to come home so I can show him the 100. And I was like, yeah. And he's like, looks at me, looks at the paper, no reaction, poker face, and said, why didn't you ask your teacher for extra credit? And it devastated me. And it set the tone for like my relationship with my dad for a very long time, which is, it doesn't matter what you're going to do. It's not going to be good enough. It doesn't matter. You're not going to be good enough. And I lived with that for well into my adulthood. I know now that all it was love. He wanted me to have a really good life here in the United States. I had this golden ticket. And when I started drinking in college, I didn't start until I was 21. And the first time I drank, I blacked out and woke up at Breckenridge with like tubes in me. And I was like, oh, it was a good night. Cool. Awesome. It was not a problem. And really, honestly, when you're in your 20s, you're like, is this just everybody being in their 20s and experimenting, and we're in college, we're drinking, or is this something darker? And I didn't know. It took until I was in my late 20s to be like, wow, I'm having 18 glasses of wine and chasing with tequila, and it's like lunch, and everybody else is drinking iced tea. Something is different. I'm not sure what it is. Like, they're just not as cool as me. I don't know. So I was put on a budget in college. I was not allowed to have a job. My job was to be a really good student, but I wanted extra money. So I got a job as a bartender and was really great at it, but ended up drinking so much that I stopped attending school. I was on dean's list my freshman year and then got like D's. I was showing up to class like hungover or not at all. But I majored in art. This is what I do now for a living, is I'm a portrait artist. But I went to school to, I studied studio art, but I also double majored in government because my parents were like, we're an Asian family. You got three choices, doctor, lawyer, engineer. That's it. I was like, I want to draw cats. I want to go to art school. And they complied. They let me go and study studio art. I had a great professor. I was really good at art and really connected with this professor named Michael Ray Charles, who's an African-American artist from New Orleans. And so I did really well in his class. When I failed out of when I was starting to slide, he pulled me aside and was like, listen, I really believe in you. I'm going to give you another chance. I had a great relationship with him. Years down the road, when I was isolated and lonely and drinking a whole lot, and didn't know how to be around people at all, I lost all people skills. There was a Starbucks across the street from where I lived, and I would go and just drink coffee, and I was like kind of around people, but I didn't have to interact with a whole lot of people. And I see this really tall guy come in with like a female, and I was like, that's Michael Ray Charles, but I don't say anything. And they get their drink and they leave. And within 2 minutes, he comes back. I'm at a table by myself. And I was so used to living life just by myself at this point. And he sits down and he goes, weren't you in my class in like the early 2000s? And I was like, yeah, I was. And he goes, I still have that painting that you gave me. It's in my office still. And I don't really know what painting he's referring to. But apparently I had given him a painting of a tree or something. And he's like, I look at that all the time and I think about you. And just jokingly, he said, so how many companies are you running right now? You must be doing really well. Like the way that he knew me when I was a freshman at school, I hadn't started drinking yet. And then towards the end of like taking he only did certain classes that I was taking. I was just starting to drink, and he had chalked it up to me being like a college student. He didn't know the depth of it. And when he had said that, this had been 8 years later, when he had said that, I looked at him and I wanted to be like, you know, I've already have all these DWIs. I have no money. I have no friends. I'm disconnected from my family. I have no ambition. The highlight of my day is going to Starbucks and hoping maybe for a little bit of human interaction. This is what my life looks like. Whereas he thought, oh, the student that I knew, if she followed that path, she would be so successful. And it really crushed me. And I didn't know what to tell him. I didn't want to be like, oh, actually, I'd run no companies. I have a huge drinking problem. That's what I have. I'm not going to say that. Like, what could I say? And I just kept thinking about that, and then went home and started drinking because it filled me with shame. And anytime shame bubbles up or any feelings bubble up, I'm like, oh, I don't like it. It's uncomfortable. And as soon as I pick up my first drink, within seconds, like it hits the back of my throat, it washes over my body, and I feel totally different. It gave me such wonderful relief, and it worked for a little bit until it totally stopped working for me. So I got out of Safe P and went to live at a halfway house in Del Valle, and I was got out of that, was on probation, and was showing up at my probation officer's place drunk, and calling her on the phone drunk too. Like, I don't know what I was doing, but I was drunk and I was calling her. She called me in, kind of busted me, and said, "Well, we're gonna still put you on. You're still gonna be on probation, but we need you to wear a scram, like that ankle monitor." And I was like, "Fuck, okay, so." And it was during the summertime or the fall, and I was wearing like shorts with like Uggs because that was the only thing that would hide it. And every now and then I still rock that look. Like, it looks good. It looks better than what you're imagining. Okay. So I was wearing a scram and was really good. Like, I didn't drink. I felt happy. I was healthy. And one Friday night, I had nothing to do, and I looked online. I found like an AA group. So I had attended a couple of AAs because it was court ordered, and I had to get that card signed. But it was never because I really, really wanted to. And then some curiosity had stirred, and I was like, let me go check out AA. So I went across the street. I didn't have a car, so walked across the street to the church, met some people. And this was around maybe Christmas time, and they said, hey, you know, do you want to go to a Christmas party? Went to the Christmas party. It was a Saturday, and the people at the party were so nice. They knew that I was new, and I never knew how they knew that I was new because it was so many people. But I think now that I've been sober almost 5 years, I look at people, I'm like, you're for sure new. Like, you just have this look like, oh my God, like, what now? You know, I'm like, how did they know I was new? There's so many people at this party. So one of the gentlemen said, if you want to, there's a meeting downstairs like Monday through Friday. It's the Allendale group in Austin. So that Monday I went at noon. And again, I walk in and the greeter's like, are you new? And I was like, oh my God. I felt seen. I felt validated. It was the best feeling. So Allendale has since then been my home group. Well, after I found Allendale, I had to scram. And about 2 months into Allendale, I got it off, and I got it off a couple days early. So I said, okay, self, you're about to get your scram off. What you're going to do now is drink only Pinot Grigio. That's it. Nothing else, just Pinot Grigio. Got the scram off, went to Bartlett's, which is like a classy restaurant, because I was like, I'm done with the low-class stuff. I'm going to drink classy like a lady now. And I did for like a couple of hours. And then I'm at Bartlett's drinking Pinot, sitting with my legs crossed and like looking good. And then what happens is when I take the first drink, I lose all control over what the night is going to look like. It hits my bloodstream and it starts that cycle of craving. Like, something in my brain tells me, if you don't get more, you will die. You have to get more. And so the Pinot wasn't enough anymore. I was like, you know what? What kind of tequila do you have? And so then started doing tequila. And then my other favorite, Jaeger bombs, which I think have... Barley's at the steakhouse. They don't make a ton of Jaeger bombs. They were like, we don't even have Red Bull. Like, no. I was like, all right, tequila, it is. So went home that night and was still really mystified. How did I have a plan to drink X amount of Pinot Grigios, surpass that amount, and then started getting to well vodka, you know? Like, I was confused. I'm like, but my plan was, and I hadn't drank in 6 months, which means I am in control of my drinking. So why did it look like that again? And come to find out in AA, they had told me, you know, the major difference between an alcoholic and a heavy user is this. When an alcoholic takes the first drink, you almost can never tell what's going to happen. You don't have control over how many you're going to do. You don't know if you're going to do cocaine, end up in Mexico. You don't know what's going to happen, who you're going to drunk text, what you're going to buy. A full turkey fryer had shown up on my porch one time. Because blackout shopping. No, you don't know what you're going to do. So an alcoholic will drink, and you can't control over, you don't have any say over how many more you're going to have and what it's going to look like. And when you stop drinking, you're thinking about the next time you're drinking. And when the consequences get really, really bad, an alcoholic will keep going. A heavy user will do the same thing, but when the consequences get bad, they're like, oh, okay, so my wife is going to leave me. I don't have custody of my children anymore. I'm going to stop because this shit is not worth it. An alcoholic's like, well, I'm so filled with shame, guilt, and remorse that the only thing that can take it away is to drink more. And I remember doing laundry in my old apartment, and there was like a shoelace or some kind of like little lace from a hoodie or something that got loose, and it got real like freaking tangled in that middle thing of the washer. And I looked at it and I was like, this is what my drinking feels like. There was no way to like get it out. You just couldn't get it out. I couldn't untangle it, unknot it. It was tangled up. I don't know where the ends were anymore. Like, how do I get it out? I just thought, oh my God, this is exactly what my life looks like. It's almost impossible to tangle. It was just so enmeshed with alcohol. After I found Allendale, I kept drinking for about 18 months and was showing up at the meeting drunk, hungover, but like lying to people about it. Like, I have the flu. They're like, it's like May. Like, you don't have the flu. You've been drinking. I got a sponsor, not because I wanted to get better, but because I wanted other women to stop asking me if I have a sponsor. I was like, yeah, I totally have a sponsor. Totally have a sponsor. July 22nd, 2014 rolls around, and I'm on like a winning streak. Like, I was getting like 7 days in a row, 15 days in a row, 20 days in a row. And I ended up drinking on the 28th day after sending out a mass text to all my friends, like, I'm going to pick up my 30-day chip on this day. I wasn't living in the day. I was trying to get the 30-day chip, you know? And I ended up drinking on day 28. I called my sponsor. I was like, I did it again. What can I do? She's like, well, it's birthday night at Northland, July birthdays. Why don't you go and support your friends who are getting a sobriety chip and ask your friend Jason, who's picking up a birthday chip, or go support your friend Jason. And while you're there, pick up a desire chip. So birthday night's huge. It's like twice as big as this. And I showed up to support Jason. And I was like, oh my God, Jason, happy sobriety birthday. Can you go and get a little desire chip for me so I can show my sponsor? And he's like, why won't you walk up there and do it yourself? And I was like, well, I picked up a lot of these. I'm ashamed. I don't want to make that walk. Everybody's going to know. And he said two things that are really, really powerful and really wonderful. In the most loving, kind way, he had said, basically, we love you, you're special, you're wonderful, but you're just not that important. Not everybody's thinking about what Lee is doing all the time. Like, no one is counting how many days since your last drink. Like, they're really worried about themselves, okay? Like, a group of alcoholics are not thinking about you. They're thinking about this one. And he's like, you're just not that important. Like, people are not thinking that about you. And also, if you're afraid to walk anywhere, if you're afraid to walk up there, why don't you do what I do, which is ask God to walk with you? And I said, okay, I'm out of options. I'm going to try. God, will you walk up there with me? And I get my desire chip. I show my sponsor. I think I ended up drinking like a couple days after that. And that would be July 22nd of 2014, where I like saw some alcohol in the bottom shelf of my a refrigerator, which I thought was a Fresca bottle. It's actually a champagne bottle that I got for my birthday, which was in December. I've had it for 7 months. There's no alcohol in the house anymore. I've forgotten about this champagne. I was like, okay, well, I guess I'll drink it. took it out. Like, really struggle with the top because it's champagne. I don't even like champagne. It doesn't do it at all for me. And so I got it open somehow and just stood, like, over the kitchen sink, and I was drinking this champagne. And, like, maybe halfway through, I kind of had this moment where I saw myself, like, barefoot in my kitchen on a Wednesday afternoon, like, just chugging champagne. And up until this point, I thought the reason why I drank was because something bad happened and I'm a victim of life and alcohol is there to make me feel better. Or something good happened and I need to celebrate life and alcohol is there to enhance the moment. But I never drank just because it was there. And when I was drinking that champagne, I knew. I was like, I'm drinking this because I have lost all power over it. It called my name. I'm a slave to it. I need it the way that I need oxygen. There's no reason for me to drink that champagne, but that it was there. And I was really frightened that my life was going to keep looking like that. That anytime alcohol was just physically present, I would just have to be called to it. And come to find out later in sobriety, it took a little bit, but alcohol was never my problem. My problem is spiritual disconnectedness. But that was enough to get me so to, you know, maybe it was a spiritual experience for me. Because I called my sponsor and I said, and I've had her for 18 months, called her like one time drunk, another time drunk, and then like one time sober just for the hell of it. Like had no contact with her and was like, I'm ready. And instead of going, oh, here we go again, or no, you're not, or all this other stuff that she, yeah, I pulled her along for 18 months. I never used her, but she was really gracious and she believed me. She didn't make me feel any sort of way. She met me the next day, July 23rd of 2014, and we got started on the steps. And after that, after I started working the steps, I wouldn't say I never felt the need to drink again, but I haven't drank since that day, all because of what's in this book, of Alcoholics Anonymous. What this book has done for me is there is this movie that I saw on Sundance Channel a while ago, and it was a bunch of people who were invited to a dinner party, and they didn't know each other, but they were like smart people. Like they had one's like a professor and then one's like an entrepreneur. And they get invited into a dinner party in some kind of a room, which is already super suspicious. You're not that smart if you're coming into this like closed-in room for a dinner party. So they all are in this room and the doors are shut and they get some kind of message through the door, through a little thing, under the wall, on the ground that said, okay, you have X amount of time to solve this math problem on the board. And if you don't solve it, every hour that you don't come up with a solution, the walls close in a little bit. And they just keep closing in until you solve this math problem. It's like a math conundrum. So that's what this like evil genius had wanted them to do, was solve this math problem in an enclosed room where the walls are moving in. And I was watching that movie and I was like, oh my God, that feels like me. Like this is how life is. The walls are just closing in and they're frantically trying to solve the problem and they can't solve the problem and the walls go and they're going crazy because they don't want to die. The walls are closing. And, you know, after I found Alcoholics Anonymous, what I equated that movie to was how my life was going. But if the answer to that math problem or that problem that was killing them, the walls were closing in, they couldn't solve the problem, it's as if somebody just slipped this under the door and was like, you want to get out of this situation? Here's the fucking solution. Read this. the walls will stop. Not only will they stop, they'll widen. The doors will open again. You'll get to live your life again. And this is what the book is like. It's like the solution to all the problems that I've ever had. And almost none of it has to do with alcohol. It has to do with self-centeredness, self-obsession. As I mentioned earlier, spiritual disconnectedness. And this book has really, 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 really enriched my life. And when I told my sponsor that having her as a sponsor was like having this candy red Ferrari in the garage that you just ignore for a year. And then one day you go in the garage and you're like, oh my God, I have a candy red Ferrari. Let me go and drive this. And it was the most amazing thing. You're like, why wasn't I driving this the whole time? This is amazing. And if you get a sponsor and you do the steps, like, you can have total freedom. You know, why stop yourself? But you do have to get a sponsor. I've not known anybody that's ever been able to do it on their own and stay sober. You might be able to survive for a little bit, but this program is a program of community, and we all help each other. There's this wonderful, wonderful experience that I love watching people pick up their chips or marbles, as you guys do here. There is this woman who was picking up a sobriety chip, and she said, you know, I was out in the redwoods in California, and I looked up at the redwood trees, and I said to myself, oh, she prefaced it by saying, if you're new and you're wondering if there's a higher power, or if you're wondering if the higher power is you, here's what my experience is. I looked up at the redwood trees, and I said, okay, did I make these redwood trees? Oh, no, I didn't. Then a higher greater than myself did. And it was as simple as that. There's a higher power than you. And the other really interesting thing about redwood trees, too, is that they are extremely old. They are extremely tall, which means that it doesn't make any sense that they would be able to withstand hurricanes and tsunamis and like all this kind of weather that happens in the hundreds of years that they're alive. The only reason why trees that tall can stand for that many years is because of the root system. The root system is only 6 feet deep, which is very shallow for a tree system, but it's really wide. It's connected to every other redwood tree. And together, they like hold hands under the dirt. And that's how they're able to sustain like these like hurricane force winds that try to knock them over, is because their root system is so strong. They're connected to every other tree, you know, and that's how they survive. This is exactly what recovery is. We all survive. There's a lot of wind out there. There's a lot of shit that life throws at us. But if we can stay connected with each other and really build our root system, I mean, that's the way to do it. And I love that about Alcoholics Anonymous. I also tried cocaine. It was just to keep my drinking. It wasn't really attached to that. I loved alcohol. And I know there might be people here who have other addictions. It's my opinion that the 12 steps outlined in this book applies to even normal people. It applies to shopping, codependency, alcohol, cheeseburgers, methamphetamine, like all of it. It covers all of it. Oh, I do want to tell one more story about this. It's a butterfly story that my mom told me when I was really, really little. And whenever it was raining outside, she would tell me the story about these butterflies. So it's like a red butterfly, a blue butterfly, white, yellow, all sorts of different color butterflies. And they're all friends. Starts raining, and they fly up to a tree. And the red butterfly is like, it's raining, Mr. Tree, it's raining. Can we come in for some shelter? And the tree's like, oh, yeah, you can. The red one can. But all the other colors, you can't. I'm only a red butterfly tree. And the red butterfly thought for a minute and was like, oh, man, I wanted my friends to be with me. So we'll just hang out and we'll find another tree. They fly up to another tree. And so this time the white butterfly is like, Mr. Tree, it's raining. Can me and my friends come in for some shelter? And the tree's like, ah, I'll take you. I'll take the white butterfly. But all the other butterflies, no, I'm just a white butterfly kind of tree. The white butterfly's like, well, damn, okay. So they all go and they keep going. The yellow butterfly, Mr. Tree, can I come in? And the tree's like, no, just the yellow butterfly. And then finally, at the very end of that, when the storm was really, really bad, you know, they come to the last tree and they're like, Mr. Tree, can we come in for some shelter? And the tree's like, yeah, of course. All of you guys are welcome. And that's just a story that like Chinese people tell their kids because it's a communist country. So it talks about like how you all have to be with each other. Everybody's equal. It's like a communism story, right? But in recovery, when I found my home group, and I found another group of alcoholics, I felt so alone for many, many, many years. I was convinced I was the only one that drank the way that I did, and there was no way out. When I found recovery, it was like finding that very last tree where you felt accepted, where you find shelter from the storm. And all my life has been like a series of different trees. You know, this tree's a relationship. It's not fulfilling. It doesn't accept me. This tree's alcohol. This tree's cocaine. This tree is food. You know, I go bounce from tree to tree to tree to tree, bar to bar to bar to bar, and never found the acceptance that I have found in the community of Alcoholics Anonymous, and recovery in general. So one last thing I want to mention is somebody had told me that about 80% of active alcoholics never make it into the rooms. And what I think is really wonderful about this group is if you're sitting here and you're an active client or you've graduated from this program, you are like the top of the pyramid. Because here's all the alcoholics down here. Some of us know about it. Some people are really struggling. They don't know they're alcoholic. They just know that their life is totally unmanageable. And from this group of people, up here are the people who are aware of it. And then those who are aware of it, up here are the people who are kind of willing to do something about it. And then up here, out of the people who are willing to do something about it, actually go and do something about it. And then way up here, the people who actually do something about it, they stick around. And then these are the people who are in this room, like the very, very top. You could be at the very, very bottom, but we're all at the very top. We're aware that we have an issue. We're willing to turn it over to God. And we have a really good fighting chance at the life that you've always wanted. I'm really happy to have been here with you guys. Thanks for having me.